From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Travesty of Justice. You're going to hear a story where you will just shake your head. Here's what's happening. That massive inferno that engulfed Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral left in its wake a blackened shell of a historic monument that survived nearly 900 years of tumultuous French history. The cathedral, immortalized in Victor Hugo's 1831 novel, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, was undergoing a massive $6.8 million renovation project when the blaze broke out. It was an effort to turn back the clock on centuries of neglect of the beloved monument. It will take years to restore. The number of measles cases reported worldwide in the first 3 months of 2019 has quadrupled compared with the same time last year, according to the World Health Organization. And here at home, the number of measles cases in the United States made its biggest jump of the year, with 90 new cases reported in just 1 week, according to numbers released by the CDC. With 555 total cases, 2019 now has the second highest number of measles cases in the United States in 25 years, and the year isn't even half over. Let's check in with Dr. Gary Ridenour. Gary, first of all, with 300 million people in this country and only 550 cases of measles, that's not a lot, is it?
Well, it's not, because of the fact that there are 1,200 cases of Ebola this year already, and 800 people have died already. There are no deaths from the measles. And I got to take a 180-degree turn on this. We joked about it before, but Rockland County in near New York City is going to put out to stay away from public places for 21 days or a $2,000 a day fine. And also, they're crafting a new order to isolate people exposed. George, what are these people doing?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's crazy, too, Gary.
This is, you know, it's America, and everyone gets the right to decide, but for a price. They're going to have measles police that are going to go house to house and apartment to apartment, making sure that you're vaccinated. Your papers, please.
Unconstitutional, Gary. What's going to happen?
Civil Liberties Union says it's an extreme measure, and the Democratic mayor has been sued by the Democratic Orthodox Jews in New York City for the neo-Nazi steps taken to try to control this outbreak.
It's crazy. And also, let me ask you this. You know, I had the measles. I never got the shot.
Yeah.
You know, I'm immune to the measles now. My kids, gosh, I can't even remember what we did with them at this point.
Exactly.
But I mean, what's wrong with just getting the measles and letting your body build up an immunity to it?
There's nothing. It's the fear that it will continue to spread down the road, where tons of people are not going to get the vaccine, and we'll have deaths and we'll have lots of hospitalizations. But that's down the road a long ways, and these draconian measures just are out of sight, overboard.
Gary's website, pandemicdirect.com. Thank you, Gary. For the first time in recorded history, scientists have created a working engineered heart using human cells by printing it on 3D. It's amazing. The advancement, which could change medicine forever, was unveiled in a study published in Advanced Science a few days ago. Russian authorities blocked a regional news website over the weekend over a report about graffiti insulting Vladimir Putin. Not smart. Under a new ban of insulting officials online, they have blocked that site. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet, will that happen here, Lauren? Could be.
Well, down the line. I mean, let's face it, Vladimir just doesn't have a good sense of humor about himself, right? Joking around about this stuff in Russia is just not very swift. But we have Russia, we have China, both of whom have very similar laws now. Russia is moving very rapidly to meet the Chinese model. The EU is moving in different censorship directions also, erroneous takedown orders, all kinds of restrictions gradually coming on board. So while we have our constitutional protections here that give us some degree of solace here, that doesn't mean that they're permanent. And we certainly have politicians here who don't like criticism or parody or satire. who speak out against the entertainment media and the news media in both parties sometimes. And if they had a way to change the law to bring that kind of censorship here, I think they'd probably give it a real good shot.
Yep, I do too.
And usually the way something like that happens is it rides on the back of something else. For example, if there's a terrorist attack, then that's, you know, in the reaction to that, you have people say, well, we need to clamp down on communications more broadly, and that's when you see these other kinds of censorship rules and laws be attempted to be pushed through. So we always have to be vigilant on this. And just because we can point at Russia and China now and say, well, that's, you know, that kind of oppression couldn't happen here, that doesn't mean we won't someday be looking into the mirror and say, it's us.
Exactly. Lauren, I want to do a complete show with you on the dark web. So after you put together some information, get a hold of Tom or Lisa and let's do it, okay?
Will do, sir.
All right, because that's an amazing story. I mean, all your information could be out there on the dark web right now, your Social Security number and all your other personal information. A Russian company called Start Rocket says it's going to launch a cluster of CubeSats into space that will act as an orbital billboard, projecting enormous advertisements into the night sky like artificial constellations. Amazing. It's the first company to ever do this, and it says its first client will be Pepsi. Stick around in a moment because my colleague George Knapp joins us for our first interview as we talk about UFOs next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, a special 2 hours with my colleague George Knapp. George, of course, is a Nevada journalist who has been honored with the highest awards in broadcast journalism, the Peabody Award. You got a couple of those, the DuPont Award from Columbia University, the Edward R. Murrow Award that is extremely prestigious. He has 27 regional Emmy Awards for investigative reporting. Just as a comparison, I have three. He's a longtime chief investigative reporter for KLAS-TV in Las Vegas, where he previously worked as a news anchor as well. He has co-authored the best-selling book, Hunt for the Skinwalker, and in 1989, his reports about Nevada Area 51's military base was selected by UPI as the best individual achievement by a reporter. Now, since 2006, he's also been our weekend host of Coast to Coast AM, and he's been associated with the program way back to the days of the late Art Bell. My pleasure to bring on the show George Knapp. Hey, good to talk to you again, George, after just seeing you a few weeks ago.
Yeah, that conversation we had in Laughlin got both of us thinking about this subject. There's a lot to cover.
There sure is. How did you, George, as an investigative reporter, get interested to investigate UFOs where, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you're the best reporter out there on this subject? How did this happen?
It kind of literally walked in the door, George. Back in 1987, I was just a regular reporter covering the mob and corruption and crime and all the normal menu of stories that Las Vegas offers.
All the fun stuff.
There's no slow news day in this town, as you know. You and Tom know this town really well. In walks the John Lear into the TV station, and he had helped our station, our news department, break a big story. We had broken the story about the existence of this stealth fighter, this plane that was out in the Nevada desert that was invisible to radar. And so he had some credibility with my news manager, a guy named Ned Day. And John walks into the newsroom with a pile of documents, puts them on Ned Day's desk, and says, Ned, this is your next big story. It's about UFOs, biggest cover-up in history. It'll make you famous. Ned looks at this material and leafs through it a little bit. He says, this can't be true. Take this away. If it were true, I'd already know about it, so I'm not going to do this story. I'd been eavesdropping, and I said to John Lear, hey, let me take a look at that stuff. And so I took it home and read it, and it was intriguing. And at the time, I hosted a little talk show called On the Record. It was one of these local public affairs type shows that air at 6 o'clock in the morning on a weekend, and nobody watches it, and your typical guest is a city councilman or county commissioner. I put John Lear on this show, and lo and behold, the public responded. He unleashed this torrent of UFO information I had never heard about conspiracies and cover-ups, and the public started calling and writing and making an inquiry. Who was that guy? I had him on again a little bit later, months later, and there was an even bigger response. And I realized that this touched the pulse of the public in a way that had not been obvious to me before. So I started reading about it. The third time Lear came on this show, he hinted that he knew a guy who was trying to get a job out at Area 51, this mysterious base that few people in the world had ever heard of at that time outside of Nevada, or unless they had worked there. And so that person turned out to be Bob Lazar, whom I met 30 years ago, almost to the month. And we started hearing his story, put him on the air in an anonymous interview, and it sort of exploded. It put Area 51 on the map. Tens of thousands of people went out there in buses with binoculars to check it out. Every media organization in the world covered the story, the allegations that Lazar made, and I was kind of on my way.
You're much like me, George. When people interview us, they ask us that question. So what do you believe in? And we always give them the reporter's answer, and that is, it's not a matter of what I believe. It's what you believe after I present the story and the facts. But I'm going to ask you, after all these stories that you have done for years and years and years, do you think we're being visited by extraterrestrials?
I don't know. I honestly don't. I mean, I think I started out after that first initial burst of digging into it, believing that it was extraterrestrials, because that was the paradigm of the time. You know, it was the prevailing viewpoint within the UFO world, and the prominent researchers at the time sort of believed that, or at least most of them did. But the more I dig into it, the less I seem to know. You know, I get that same question everywhere I go, George. Grocery stores and restaurants, you know, do you really believe this stuff? And I say, well, you know, when people ask me that, it's because usually they want to tell me their UFO story, and everyone has one. And I don't believe it in the sense of like it's a religion. I believe it's an interesting story that, if you could be proven, would be the biggest ever. It would change everything.
It sure would. When you were interviewing Lazar, did your eyes roll, or did you say to yourself, hey, this guy might be onto something?
No, I was skeptical, and I was wary because, you know, for a mainstream news reporter, this is risky stuff. And he was telling me stuff I'd never heard of before. I had no idea about the whole world of UFOs and conspiracies and disinformation and subterfuge and treachery that is so common in the field. It was a baptism of fire. It took many months for me to get comfortable with it. Being able to separate wheat from chaff. I read everything on the topic that I could find. I tried to figure out who in the field was believable and who wasn't. And Lazar's story, even by today's standards, it is 30 years later. It's 30 years now, was pretty tough to digest. We started digging into his background to try to get a handle on how much of his story we could corroborate. And there was quite a bit, as it turned out. And more importantly, I'll never be able to go to the places where he said he worked and to see the things that he said he saw. But it was obvious that there was an attempt to obscure his background, to wipe out any claims of the places where he worked, to discredit work that I know that he did. And most importantly of all, he seemed to know things that he shouldn't have known otherwise. The most dramatic incident of that is that he knew when the test flights were taking place, because he took people out there 3 weeks in a row, stationed outside a base that does not exist then or now. And sure enough, these what looks like flying saucers flew up over the mountains at the time when he said they would be there. They videotaped them. So how did he know? And that sort of got me hooked.
George Knapp with us, and we're going to be talking about some incredible things that George has covered, including his work on Hunt for the Skinwalker. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with him. And folks, trust me when I tell you, there is no reporter like George Knapp in the country who is as efficient as what he does. Linda Moulton Howe does a great job, but George is a true investigative journalist who just keeps going for that story. And do you think one day, George, we will get, as Stephen Bassett thinks, disclosure?
I do not. I think that if we're talking about disclosure with a capital D, where the president comes out and makes some kind of a speech or announcement and says, you know, the aliens are here, it's true, they've been visiting us, there isn't much we can do about it, I don't see that happening. It would be incredibly disruptive, and I think probably unsettling to a big bunch of people. I think what we're seeing right now is a form of disclosure without the capital D. It's in essence, it's confirmation. It's a really exciting time, maybe the most exciting time in all the years that I've covered it. So many pieces seemingly in motion on the UFO subject, more than any other time since I've been chasing it. So much energy, new people interested and active, and things are moving. I mean, probably the most important change is the the rest of the media are finally catching up to you and coast to coast on this subject, George, because the media environment has totally changed. The New York Times, when they broke out this story in December of 2017 about a secret Pentagon study of UFOs, that changed everything. It made it acceptable for other news media to cover the topic, and they did. The Washington Post, the LA Times, the CNN, and Fox, multiple Fox broadcasts still 14, 15 months later, and Newsweek and Time and publications that don't normally take this seriously have taken it seriously. The result is people on Capitol Hill, staff members of Congress, even elected members of Congress are now paying attention to it. And I'm sure we'll get into some details about that later. But the ball has really been moved down the field. It is a remarkable change in a short period of time. And as I said, for somebody like me, it's really exciting. I did not expect disclosure. I don't expect a formal announcement. But I think what we're already seeing is a series of individual events, seemingly unrelated, but all heading in the same direction.
I share your skepticism about disclosure, George. I think if we get it, it's going to be whistleblowers and people that you uncover, we uncover, who come forward and just tell us the way it is, and hopefully sooner than later. But it's an amazing subject. And you do find now that the media seems to be picking up more and more on these stories, where years ago it was kind of like swept under the carpet. But they seem really interested these days, don't they?
Well, big time. I think we have to give credit, a lot of that credit, to the stars. Tom DeLong is a rock star. He's not the guy you expect to make a big splash on this subject, but the guy really applied himself to it. He got in touch with a series of higher and higher ups, got them to talk to him. I know that a lot of people in the UFO community are suspicious of that, but he was sort of keeping me in the loop each step of the way as it happened. And I think the crowning achievement was a guy named Luis Elizondo. Lou Elizondo came forward. He had been in charge of this Pentagon program. He quit because he felt it wasn't getting the resources and attention that it deserved. He was a counterintelligence and intelligence operative. It put his life on the line for the American public many times in his career. And he came forward and spoke about it, what he had learned, and said, in fact, this had been taken seriously at the highest levels, that the Pentagon did not stop the study of UFOs in 1969 when Project Blue Book ended, which is, you know, the official line is that that's when they stopped because there was nothing to study, that it wasn't a matter of national security interest. And, of course, we always suspected that was not the case, and now we've had it confirmed that it wasn't. Those guys, along with a fellow named Chris Mellon, who from the Mellon family, a wealthy and influential family, he had chosen a life of public service, worked for in intelligence capacity on Capitol Hill, and then for the Defense Department in two different administrations, Jim Semivan, a guy from the CIA, Dr. Hal Puthoff, a physicist. People of that caliber came forward and said, this stuff is true. It needs to be studied. And that seems to be what's happening. We don't have a full picture of everything that's going on behind the scenes, but it's pretty clear from what we know that quite a bit is in play.
It sure is, and we're going to talk a lot more about what you've been doing, George, in this field. We'll talk about Bob Bigelow. I want to take a quick moment, too, George, and thank you for your participation on Coast to Coast. I mean, you are just a staple for us, and for me personally, it just feels great to know that I've got somebody of your caliber doing these shows on weekends, keeping things going, and I just want you to know how much we appreciate you.
Well, I appreciate you your support, George. And, you know, I tell people when they ask about it that you have had my back the whole time I've been there. And I get a really kick out of doing the show. It's a different format for me. You can do a lot of – you can cover a lot of ground in 4 hours, as you know.
Oh, and, you sure can. Do you ever get tired? I mean, you're working full-time as a television reporter. You're doing our shows. But we somehow seem to get energy the older we get, don't we?
Well, yeah, I feel that way, and as I said, it's a really exciting time now. I'll sleep when I'm dead, and you know, it feels like a golden opportunity to move the ball down the field right now. It's an exciting time.
Stay with us. George Knapp is with us. He is one heck of a reporter and my colleague here on Coast to Coast. He's been associated with the show way back during the days of Art Bell as well. We're going to come back and talk more with him about some of these issues, including Bob Bigelow. How important was he to the field of ufology, and where is he now? And also, George has a book out. He's got a couple, but he's got a film that is called Hunt for Skinwalker, and his book is called Hunt for Skinwalker. We'll talk about that, too. And calls with George next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Knapp with us. George, tell us about this fellow by the name of Bob Bigelow. Of course, you know him well. He was a hotel magnate, and then he decided he wanted to go into space. He's got some floating pods up there, but he got interested in UFOs. Tell us more.
He got interested in UFOs a long time ago. He had an experience with members of his family when he was very young, and it sort of sunk its teeth into him and never let go. As in 1989, when we first broke the Area 51 Bob Lazar stories, that's when he reached out to me for the first time. I had never heard of him before, but he was very interested in UFOs, had reached a point of success in his professional career where he had the resources to pursue it, and boy, did he. From that point on, I think he spent more money than any person in the history of the world on trying to figure this stuff out. Not only UFOs, but also life after death, consciousness, the kind of issues that are even now cutting edge and that mainstream scientists are trying to get their heads around. He started his own organization called NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Science. He's spent millions of dollars in support of other research organizations, the names that we know pretty well. NIDS, he had his own rapid response team that would go to UFO hotspots, places like Skinwalker Ranch. He had a science advisory board consisting of academics, a couple of astronauts, a couple of U.S. senators, of former intelligence officials who all gave their time and put their reputations and their careers on the line to tackle these subjects, and he's done it. And then in addition to NIDS, after that sort of faded away, he created a company called BASS within his Bigelow Aerospace Company. BASS was the host organization for a secret Pentagon study of UFOs and related phenomena. It was much more than just flying saucers. It looked at paranormal activity, crop circles, cattle mutilations, and a lot of really strange stuff. We can get into details about what they accomplished, but it was an amazing thing. And the public never heard about it until years after the program, the money was taken away. Bigelow is viewed in the UFO field with suspicion, as pretty much everyone is. Mm-hmm. They figure he's got to be some CIA front, or he's described as shadowy. All he's done is put his own money and time and resources into trying to figure this stuff out. And he gets pilloried for it pretty regularly. But he's an amazing man. He's a brilliant man. He's got multiple patents. He started his own aerospace company from scratch. He committed up to $500 million to do his own space program. It's inflatable space habitats. He got the technology from NASA, improved it. He had two spacecraft up there, Genesis 1 and 2, and then right now, at this moment, one of his craft is attached to the ISS, the International Space Station. It's a tough sledding in that racket.
Has he kind of backed away, George, from the UFO field?
Yeah, in 2016, he sold the Skinwalker Ranch. He withdrew his financial support for all the research, and he just focused on his aerospace activities. He figured he had to take a shot and concentrate all of his resources into that to make it a go. I think there are probably other reasons involved in backing away from it. But look, he has a lifelong interest in this subject. I saw him a couple of days ago. I know he's still interested. He tries to keep tabs on what goes on, but he's not as active as he once was. That may not be permanent. You never know.
Well, he was interviewed on 60 Minutes, and he took a really diehard approach that he believes we're being visited.
Yeah, that was an interesting piece, and it gets repeated on social media all the time. There's Bob Bigelow being interviewed by Lara Logan, and ostensibly they said they wanted to talk to him about his aerospace program, but in reality they wanted to know about UFOs and Skinwalker Ranch, and so they asked him flat out, "Do you believe they're here?" And he said, "Yeah, they're here, and the evidence is right in front of us. I mean, it's right all around us." And they asked him, "Aren't you worried that people will say you're crazy?" He said, "No, it doesn't matter. Make any difference. I know what's real and what isn't." And that's pretty bold for a guy in his position to go ahead and say.
Former Senator Harry Reid somehow got involved in this, authorized or helped push for millions of dollars in research into the UFOs. Some people say he did that to help Bob Bigelow, who's one of his constituents. What's the bottom line on that story?
Well, Harry Reid was interested in UFOs before I ever knew of Bob Bigelow, or before Bigelow was supporting UFO research in any public way anyway. In 1989, when we did these stories, and again, it's 30 years ago this spring, when we did these stories about Area 51, I had already talked to Harry Reid. I had approached him when I first heard this information. He's the first person I told outside our newsroom about Bob Lazar and his allegations and S4 and Papoose Lake. And it was, I know it was in a limousine going to McCarran Airport. He was flying back to Washington, and we had a chat. He said, that's interesting. I'm going to look into that. He doesn't endorse it necessarily, but he's interested. And that interest has helped me a great deal over the years. Because although Harry Reid didn't want to be out in front, he didn't want to be known as the UFO senator. I mean, after all, he does want to get reelected. He helped me behind the scenes. And each year or so, I'd go back to interview him about this or that. And some of those were pretty tough interviews, but he and I would always go off to the side and have a little chat about UFOs. We'd whisper this and that about what was going on in the field. It would drive his staff crazy because he wouldn't tell them what we were talking about, and neither would I. And then from time to time, he helps me get documents and things of that sort, and then I would fill him in on what was going on. In 1995, when Bob Bigelow created NIDS, I told Senator Reid about it. I said, this is a pretty amazing group of people. Edgar Mitchell was on the Science Advisory Board. There was another U.S. senator, an astronaut there, a lot of people with great reputations. I told him about the meetings that were taking place. He said, well, maybe I can go over there and check it out. And I arranged it. And he came over and sat in on a couple of the meetings with the Bigelow organization, and he was hooked. A couple of years go by. I was in Washington to interview Senator Reid about something else, about the space chimps, the chimpanzees that have been raised for the space program, mm-hmm. who had been mistreated. They were in a medical facility being injected with diseases, all kinds of things. Reid agreed to help. And when I went to Washington to talk to him about it, there was Senator John Glenn. And we had a chat about UFOs, and Glenn was interested as well. And I think Senator Reid had always been looking for an opportunity to do something on this. In 2007, it happened. Defense Intelligence Agency, there were some people in that agency that were interested in UFOs and related phenomena. They read our book on Hunt the Skinwalker, and this particular scientist asked Bigelow for permission to go to the ranch, and he did. He flew to Las Vegas, got on Bigelow's jet, flew to Skinwalker Ranch, and he had an experience there, a very dramatic experience, went back to Washington, looked up Senator Reid, said, we need to study this. Reid had a meeting with two fellow senators, Daniel Inouye and Ted Stevens of Alaska. They controlled sort of black budget items. They agreed to get some money together, put out a bid. The bid was posted like any other defense contract, and Bigelow Aerospace got the contract. Now, yeah, Bob Bigelow is from Nevada, but he's a billionaire. He doesn't need the money. He spent more money on the program and the study that followed than he got from the government. And he retrofitted his buildings. He provided the facilities. He spent millions of his own dollars before and after the government contract was done. And if it had been allowed to continue, I think we could actually have some answers by now. But it wasn't. After a couple of years, Reid was no longer the Senate Majority Leader, and the money was pulled for reasons that are a little bit murky. But I can tell you that program, which was under the auspices of something called BASS, which is the Bigelow Aerospace Systems program company, and the program itself was called ALSAP, Advanced Aerospace Weapons, is the basic acronym. Mm-hmm. And they studied all kinds of stuff. They put together what is probably the world's biggest UFO database with information from multiple foreign countries. They did their own boots on the ground study of UFO incidents, medical effects. They wrote, I think, 38 papers that were published for the official contribution to DIA. But there's a much bigger database that the public has never seen.
George, you mentioned that you chatted with John Glenn for a little bit when you saw him. I've always been fascinated with astronauts like Gordon Cooper and Edgar Mitchell, who claim to have some information about UFOs as well. Now, Mitchell always told us he never saw anything, especially when he was on the moon, but he's told by people that these things exist. Did Glenn say anything to you?
He didn't tell me what he had seen, but he definitely let me know it was something, and that his interest was born of personal experience. I don't think he, because I only met him the one time, so I don't think he trusted me enough to go ahead and tell me, even though Senator Reid trusted me. But, you know, he was among many people in the space program and many people in Congress who've had these experiences whose interest they didn't want to make public. They didn't want people to say they're crazy. But there's a lot of them in the Pentagon and in intelligence agencies and entertainment and pretty much everywhere in the world.
Tell me about your interest in the Skinwalker Ranch with Hunt for Skinwalker, for the Skinwalker.
So that started in 1996. The NIDS organization had been put together. They're looking for things to do, places to study. And there was a story in a little Utah newspaper about this place in the Uinta Basin, northeastern Utah, where strange things happen. Turns out it was not just a UFO hotspot, which it had been for as long as humans have lived in that part of the country, more than 250 years. Strange lights and objects in the sky seen by Native Americans, by early Mormon settlers, and by people who live there now. And this particular property, 480 acres, a beautiful piece of property lined by a Skinwalker Ridge, it's called. Bigelow had heard about the activity that was on the property, heard about the difficulties the rancher and his family were having, and so he came in and bought the place, and he put a team of investigators in there with cameras and scientific equipment, and for the next 7 or 8 years, they were on the ranch basically 24/7 just to check out. They started with looking at UFOs, but quickly realized it went a lot further beyond that. They had animal mutilations, animals that disappeared, strange creatures, crypto creatures, disembodied voices, balls of light and orbs, UFO craft of every size and shape and description, poltergeist-type activity, crop circles, everything you could imagine. And it never happened the same way once. I've seen the reports. They had 143 different incidents while the NIDS guys were on the ranch. These are PhD scientists, physicists, and microbiologists, and veterinarians, and a team of professional investigators and trackers, and they were mystified and scared. Some of the stuff that happened was downright frightening. It never really hurt people except psychologically, but the ranch family that had been through this for 20 months on their own, they were a rock-solid family, and by the time the 20 months was up and NIDS was there, they were scared to death. They were psychologically damaged. They were sleeping in one room on the floor at night for protection from whatever it was that was besieging them. It is a mystery. It was a mystery. Science gave its best shot to try to figure this stuff out, and science got its butt kicked. They couldn't figure it out. It's not as simple as saying it's aliens. We don't know what it is.
Is it still a mystery, George?
It is. You know, Bigelow sold the property in 2016 in part because there are risks to studying this. And we haven't been too clear about it because some of the information and the incidents that happened were part of the classified program. But I can tell you that investigators would show up on that property, and whatever it is that's there tends to size you up. And people that went in with an attitude that challenged it, that were packing heat, took guns and figured they weren't going to be afraid of anything, they're the ones that suffered the most. And it's not only things that happen on the property. We have found that it follows people. It attaches itself to people. It spreads. It follows them home, and then the same kind of activity happens where they live. And it's very upsetting to these professional intelligence people who were there on the property. Some of that activity is ongoing. Bigelow sold the property in 2016. He wanted to be done with it. There's a new owner who's infused new money and energy into it, and who has vowed to keep the scientific study of whatever it is ongoing. I think we're going to be hearing more about that in the next year or so. And it's exciting. It's scary, but exciting.
It seems like whatever's out there, whatever entity or entities are out there, they seem to go after the aggressive ones, the people who, like you said, bring guns and things like that. They seem to go after them harder.
That's exactly right. Somehow, whatever it is, it sizes you up when you get there. And it sort of is playful at times. At best, it's benign. And sometimes it's downright mean. It seems to be almost like a psychic vampire in that it in some manifestations, it feeds off of human fear. There's one incident where the rancher and his wife had seen some really strange things, weird creatures, poltergeists, things inside their home, So they weren't easily frightened after a while, but there were these blue orbs that would appear at times, scared the heck out of the animals, would drive them off cliffs, things of that sort. These blue orbs were larger than a softball. They looked like they were made out of blue and glass. They had a blue swirling liquid inside. And when it got close, it literally drove them to their knees with fear, way outside the bounds of what should be normal, as if it was sort of activating the fight or flight access in your brain. That was among the strangest activity. They had animals that were mutilated literally almost before their eyes. Their dogs were vaporized. They had a calf mutilation on a bright sunny morning when they were right there on the property and should have been able to hear it. A lot of really strange stuff that scared them, literally scared them off the property, and has frightened dozens of researchers since. Now, I've been on the ranch a couple dozen times in the years since. Mr. Bigelow allowed me to be there. I was going to create a documentary shooting this film from around 2000 on. I've never seen anything. I mean, I've seen some lights and things of that sort.
Did you feel anything strange?
I felt good at the property, and I had to remark after my sixth or seventh visit, I said, this will sound weird to everybody talking about this strange, scary stuff, but I feel good here. I get a good energy about it, like I stuck my finger in an electric socket, and other people have reacted the same way. There's something there. I did not see it, and I'll tell you this. I did carry something home, and again, it wasn't something I experienced. It's something somebody else in my family did, and other people who've been on the property have had the same thing.
Jeez. But it followed you.
Yeah, it followed me. I tried to engage it for a long time. I tried to bring things home and see if something would pop up. There were a lot of experiments, both by NIDS and by BASS, to try to engage with it, to have a conversation of some sort, and to communicate. And it looked like they were going to succeed for a while, and then this thing, it would slam the door shut. You know, you'd set up cameras in a place where there'd been activity for a couple of days. It would move somewhere else.
It would do it all. George, we're going to come back and talk more and take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.